Well, hello, this is Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, and you are listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind.
We mean to make things over. We are tired of toil for naught, with but bare enough to live upon, and ne'er an hour for thought. We want to see the sunshine, we want to smell the flowers. We are sure that God has willed it, and we mean to have 8 hours. We're summoning our forces from shipyard, shop, and mill. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will.
Well, that was the 8-hour song. That was the song that kicked off the struggle for the 8-hour day back in the late 1800s. This is me, Utah, with Steve Baker here pushing the slides and doing the engineering and doing a splendid job of it, yes, because it's a job, a thankless task, which I have chosen not to learn. The music of the Borsdorfs, of course, and I still haven't figured out where they are these days. They migrate around. We are here in the studios of KVMR, the jewel in the crown, the thorn in the side, the pain in the butt, Nevada City, California. It is May Day. Now, I had intended to redo this show on Sunday. I normally broadcast it out to the Sacramento area live on Sunday, but I came back from the big May Day celebration down in San Francisco, and I'm just too damn tired to be able to do it. Now, it is May Day today. This is Tuesday, and we are in the production studio, and I do not care what your spatio-temporal reality is or when. I am concerned only with my own at this moment. May Day, the fight against the upper crust, which, as you know, is a handful of crumbs held together by a wad of dough. I want to address myself particularly to young people. I do get a good bit of correspondence from young people, mainly because of the records with Ani DeFranco. A lot of curiosity about labor, the labor movement, a lot of curiosity about anarchism. And I think that's what I want to wade into. A little complicated. Some of these shows take a little bit more thought than other ones, so I have to kind of focus myself. Well, May Day is a good place to start. Start with the Haymarket. Of course, May Day was Beltane in antiquity, pre-Christian times in Europe, one of the great cross-quarter days, the time when you go out and sow the fields, you begin your planting. Well, people were accustomed to celebrating that day for 1,000 years or longer. Of course, immigrant people came from Europe over the centuries to the United States and brought that custom with them. When the industrial system started, the factory system, beginning of the Industrial Revolution, big events were planned for May Day because people were accustomed to celebrating that anyway. 1880, the forerunner of the American Federation of Labor sent a circular to all of its locals, as well as the Knights of Labor, and said, nobody work longer than 8 hours. Nobody work longer than 8 hours. Well, it's hard to make it stick. But even at that, there were strikes of 50 and 60,000 people. Some of them even won. But the momentum built. The 8-hour movement built and built. Until finally, May 1st, 1886, it was to be the kickoff for the final push for the 8-hour day all over the country. The rally in Chicago was sponsored, one of them was sponsored by the anarchists, which was a very powerful movement at the time, and they really knew what that word meant, too. It took place in the Haymarket, where they brought the big hay wagons in to sell the hay, a large open space in Chicago. Speakers on the platform, somebody threw a bomb, and people were killed. The police fired into the crowd, and a lot of workers were killed. Over 300 of them were wounded. That was the Haymarket disaster, the Haymarket riot. Well, the people on the stage, the speakers, were arrested. They were thrown in jail, the Haymarket martyrs. They were tried, they were convicted of murder, and they were executed in 1887 by being hanged there in Chicago. Well, the word went out all around the world. The American Federation of Labor sent word all around the world, say, remember this day, remember this day. So May Day, as it's celebrated today globally, in China, all over Africa, and all over Europe, the International Day of Labor Solidarity began in Chicago, May 1st, 1886. At the time of the execution, there was a party going on in Rochester, New York. Some young women were at sort of a coming out party. When news reached the party that the Haymarket defendants had been executed, they began to whoop and shout and clap their hands, all except one who threw herself on the rest of the young women in a rage and had to be carried off forcibly. That was the young Emma Goldman. That's when her career as an anarchist began, Red Emma. Red Emma Goldman, who said, "That which is best and most beautiful in the human spirit arises in spite of the state and not because of it." Well, here's one of the songs that was sung there at the Haymarket in 1886, and here's Pete Seeger to tell you about it.
100 years ago, 1871, there was a man running for his life. He was a textile worker, 56 years old. He'd been elected mayor of his district of Paris during the Paris Commune. Now the Commune had fallen, surrounded by the guns of all Europe, and he knew if he was caught, it was execution immediately. He was in hiding. That very month of May, 1871, he writes 6 long verses and a chorus, confidently calling on all the oppressed people of the world to overthrow their masters. 15 years later, amnesty had been declared. He was able to live in France openly. I think he went to England and then America for a while. But on his deathbed, his friends printed a volume of the poems he'd written all his life. This was one of them. A copy of the book comes to the hands of a young man who puts a tune to it. Within 10 years, the song had swept not only through France, but through Europe. And then they made a big mistake. They made it official. I decided there's one worse thing than banning a song. That's making it official. And translations don't work so well anyway. I'm going to sing you the song in the original French, because I think it's a good song. When they make things official, they slow them down, you just hear the first verse anyway. I don't really know French. I hope those of you who do will pardon my lack of a good accent. Debout les dames de la terre, debout les forces de la faim. La raison tournant son cratère, c'est l'éruption de la fin. Tout passé fait dans table rase, pour l'esclave debout, debout. Le monde va changer de base, nous ne sommes rien, soyons tout. C'est la lutte finale. Reprends-nous et demain l'international sera le genre humain. C'est la lutte finale. Reprends-nous et demain l'international sera le genre humain. Wake up, you prisoners of hunger. The world is changing at the base. We who have been nothing will be everything. Of the past, we shall make a clean slate. Still, Peter's French, though. says, it's the final battle. Then he says, we need no supreme saviors, no God, no Caesar. Producers, save yourselves. Heat up your own forge. Soufflons nous même notre forge. Blow upon the forge and make it hot. Beat on the iron while it is hot. Il n'est pas de soldats suprême, ni Dieu, ni César, ni Tribun. Producteurs, sauvons-nous nous-mêmes, décrétons le salut commun, pour que le voleur en de gorge pour tirer l'esprit du cachot. Soufflons nous-mêmes notre forge, battons le fer quand il est chaud. C'est la lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le jour romain. C'est la lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le jour romain. Sing all six verses, but it says, the kings intoxicate us with gun smoke. If they insist upon making heroes of us, they will learn that our bullets are for our own generals. Workers, peasants, are we all? The world belongs to everyone. How many feed upon our flesh? But if one day these buzzards, these vultures would all disappear, the sun will shine always. Ouvriers paysans, nous sommes la grande partie des travailleurs. La terre n'appartient qu'aux hommes. Voici fira l'ogéraille. Combien de nos chasseurs épaissent, mais si les cobolds et vautours, un de ces matins disparaissent, le soleil brillera toujours. C'est la lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le jour romain. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le jour romain.
Pete Seeger explaining where the Internationale comes from. A May Day today, that song is being sung all around the world in probably every language that you can think of. Somebody is singing that song. Well, that time that we're speaking of, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, well up into this century, that was the time of the robber barons, they were called. The Jay Goulds. Jay Gould, who said, I can hire one half of the working class to shoot down the other half. And oh, didn't they? It was a time of the bloodbaths and the great railroad strikes when at the drop of a hat, they'd call out the National Guard and begin blazing away at the workers who are trying to fight for some kind of decent human life. That was the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies. Well, it was Andrew Carnegie, the steel magnate. That was the Homestead Strike, 1892 in Pittsburgh. Now, this is not things that you learned in your textbooks at school, you young folks. This is not, you didn't learn this in your high school history book about the Homestead. That's when the militia came out and gunned down the steel workers, you know, and really tried to break the back of the steel workers union. It was Amalgamated Steel at that time. Andrew Carnegie. Now, some of you know the name Carnegie, but you know it because you've got a little stone or brick building in your town called a Carnegie Library. And, oh, we love those libraries. They're fine buildings. They're fine spaces. And we just love libraries generally. Those were the gift of Andrew Carnegie, the philanthropist. Nobody ever bothered to explain where he got the money to do that, however. But we'll hang on to the libraries. We'll hang on to them. The one here in Nevada City, by God, we're going to have to take that one over again and turn it into a children's library so kids don't have to walk across the highway to get to the new library. But that's a whole different story. Let us, however, have no illusions about the name Andrew Carnegie. Here's a poem that I'll offer you by Alice T. Sorensen. This comes from the Miner's Magazine in Colorado, 1902, poem called Andrew Carnegie's Library. There's a scent on the books of dead men's bones and a splatter of blood over all. There's a rough, ragged hole on each leaf you turn, like the wound from a rifleman's ball. There's the last gasp of men shot down at command of this generous and gracious man. There's the blood and the groans, the grief and the shame. You picture it, any who can. There's a picture of Homestead. Will we ever forget how those brave, ragged were defenselessly slain, were slaughtered like beasts, like poor hunted beasts, by Carnegie's will for Carnegie's gain? Will we ever forget how the mothers and wives in their rags, in their woe, knelt down in the dust and clasped their loved dead soon after they fell by rifleman's ball or bayonet's thrust? Will we ever forget how the press of the land made light o'er the slaughter by saying the dead were foreign-born men who, in impudence, asked for the right to be earning their bread? Will we ever forget how, in sweatshop and mind, the fathers and mothers and children were slain, how virtue is bartered and childhood is crushed by Carnegie's will for Carnegie's gain? How the skeleton babes at the unnurtured breast give their poor little lives to his greed. How the girls on the street and the mothers in rags are reflecting his generous deeds. And this is his gift, all reeking with blood, the gift that he proffers with arrogant hand. And this is his penance for murder and lust. And this is his jest to the slaves of the land. But the books are not dumb. They have eloquent tongues to tell you their pitiful story, how the bodies and souls of women and men have built him his temple of glory, how the walls are of bones cemented with blood and wet with the dropping of tears of hearts that have broken for unwritten wrongs these hundreds and hundreds of years. Fred Holstein, The Banks of Marble.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore, and it really made me wonder at the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer plowing sodden loam, and I've heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the walls are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I've heard the bosses saying, got no work for you no more. But the banks are made of marble, with the guard the weary miner, scrubbing coal dust from his back. And I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble, with the guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the mine has sweated for. I've seen the weary old folk without nickel left to give, and the hovels that they exist in are not fit for rats to live. But the banks are made of marble, with the guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the old folks sweated for. I've seen our people working throughout this mighty land, and I've prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we'd own those banks of marble, with the guard at every door. And we'd share those vaults of silver that we all have sweated for.
Yeah. Oh, Chicago Fred Holstein. That was A Dozen Wobblies there, recording a song for the album for the Industrial Workers of the World at Holstein's Bar in Chicago. It was over one Labor Day a while back. Well, wither the labor movement, you know, wither. That event, the bomb that was thrown at the Haymarket and the busting of all of those rallies, that put a stop to the eight-hour movement for, 20 years or better, you know. But we got it through persistence, through a lot of pain, through a lot of terror. We did get it. Today, you know, you're not working down underground in a coal mine if you're 15, 16, 17 years old or 10 years old. You don't have to have brothers or sisters that are in the weave rooms, that are in the sweatshop at a young age, because there's no safety standards. It has changed. It has changed. What has changed? We got the eight-hour day. Listen, you want to think about the labor movement? Don't let anybody tell you the labor movement never did anything or that it's outlived its usefulness. You got Saturday and Sunday. The labor movement gave you the weekend. People used to work 7 days a week. The labor movement fought for and won the weekend, but also mine safety laws and child labor laws. Why, that movement gave us Social Security. It gave us workmen's compensation. It gave us the minimum wage. None of those were benevolent gifts from an enlightened management. Oh, no. The boss fought and kicked and screamed every inch of the way, but we won, and we have those things. And let me tell you, we're going to hang on to those things tooth and nail. This movement has got to grow, and you've all got to be a part of it. Otherwise, we will gradually, and you can see it happening, slip back into an industrial dark age. We have to understand that there is power in the union.
There is power, there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
Have you got that again? You understand the chorus? Everybody got it now? All right.
Oh, would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? How would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do you share? There is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land. one industrial union brand. Oh, would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack that's away in the back? Or would you have wings up in heaven to fly and start here with a rag on your back? But there is power in a band working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand. Oh, if you like sluggers to feed in your head, don't organize, all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand. So come all ye workers from every land, and come join the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule in every land, one industrial union brand.
Well, that was a rally with the communications workers up there in British Columbia who had been out. They hadn't had a contract in 2 years, and boy, they all knew what they were singing about, didn't they? Well, all right, what happened? You know, so the letters that I get, especially from young people, particularly from young people, the question that sort of underlies everything that they write to me about the condition of their lives is, what was it like when I was their age? What was the world like then? It's almost as if you could say there was one world and then everything changed, now there's this other one. And they're curious about what it was, that time of great social foment, that time of great agitation. Well, yeah, a hole was blown in the world, and it was called the Cold War. It was the Great Depression. Maynard Keynes, the economist, told Roosevelt, there's nothing built into capitalism to keep it from spiraling down forever. It could just keep going down. You've got to socialize investment. You've got to take large amounts of public money and invest it in the private sector. Of course, it takes a war to do that if you want to do it efficiently. Take a lot of public money and put it into defense spending. That was happening all over the world, you know, because it was a global depression. Second World War. An enormous amount of public money went into private hands, and absolute fortunes were built. We were all fighting against the fascists, which was a worthwhile fight. We were fighting against a total enemy, fascism. But we brought... That's what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, came together. Well, we defeated the total enemy. Huh? Well, what happened? Were they going to take that system apart? No, it was a money pump. As I say, it was creating fortunes. But you got to find another total enemy to justify it. And there it was, huh? The international communist conspiracy. The Russians had been our allies during the Second World War fighting the fascists, but now they were the new total enemy, so you could keep that military-industrial complex privatizing public money and creating fortunes. The purpose of the Cold War was threefold. The first I've already described, to take public money and put enormous amounts of it into private hands, was to discredit socialism globally. If any country, then or today, elects a government and the new president stands up and talks about nationalization of resources and land reform, he's going to have a foreign army, he's going to find out his currency is no good on the international market, he's either going to be bankrupt or he's going to be physically destroyed. Capitalism announced ever since the Spanish Civil War it will tolerate no system alternative to itself. Well, I've been wanting to get that one out for a long, long time. That was the hole that was blown in the world. It's going to take this country 100, maybe 200 years to recover from the damage that the Cold War did. We're now picking up the threads, weaving them back together again into a tapestry of struggle. Well, you say, what was it like? What was it like in 1950? Here's a song about what it was like, but this song is also about what it could be like unless we're real, real careful and work real, real hard. The Cry of the Morning, Rebel Voices.
They call it the law.
Apartheid,
conscription,
partition,
and silence. It's the law that they made to keep you and me where they think we belong. They live behind steel, bulletproof glass, machine guns and spies, and tell us who suffer the tear gas and torture that we're in the wrong. If they come in the morning, no time to show fear or pour tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. And the wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. The trade union leaders, the writers, the rebels, the fighters and all, and the strikers who fought with the cops at the factory gates, sons and the daughters of unnumbered heroes who paid with their lives, and the poor folks whose cry of freedom was their only mistake. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or pour. No time for goodbyes. No time to ask why. And the wail of the siren is the cry of the morning.
They took away Sacco,
Vanzetti,
Walesa,
and Conley and Pearson their time. They came for Newton and Seal, the Panthers and some of their friends in Warsaw, Chicago, Saigon, Santiago, Cape Town and Belfast. And the places that never made headlines, the list never ends. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or pour tears in the morning. No time to ask why. And the wail of the siren is the cry of the morning.
The boys in blue, they're only a few of the everyday cops on their beat.
CIA branchmen and spies and informers, they do their jobs well. Behind them, the men who tap phones, take pictures and program computers and file. And the ones who give the orders, which tell the men to come and take you to a cell. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or pour tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. Iron is the cry of the morning.
So come all you people to give to your sisters and brothers the will to fight on.
They say get used to the war, that doesn't mean the war isn't on. The fish need the sea to survive, just like your comrades need you. And the death squads can only get to them if first they can get through to you. No time for love if they come in the morning. No time to show fear or pour tears in the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. And the wail of the siren is the cry of the morning. No time for goodbyes, no time to ask why. And the wail of the is the cry of the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny Hall. Well, now, it was old Tom Scribner, the old wobbly, joined the union in 1916, a working logger. I knew him. He's an old man down there in Santa Cruz. He said to me once, you know, it's a lot harder for you young people today than it was for us. I say, Tom, you talk about having logs roll over you and almost killing you. How can you say it's harder for us? He said, well, you look at it this way. We all assign blame in our own best interest. But if we assign blame in our own best interest, then blame is relative. And if blame is relative, then the important function in society is who controls the blame pattern. Why would millions of workers, honest working people, assign blame for what's wrong downward? Oh, that's just a bunch of welfare shizzlers. They want something for nothing, and never think of assigning it upward to the handful of people who own all this and don't do a damn thing for it. That's because the blame pattern is manipulated. Tom said, you know, you abandon your children to authorities and institutions over which they have no control. They're like empty milk bottles, and stuff is poured into them, you see. And finally, they get out of school, get their first job, get their television set, sit down in front of that television set. The schools and the media have built in automatic levers and automatic buttons, and they can reach out through that television and elicit massive support for anything that they choose to. Well, so it seems to me that maybe growing up is taking that milk bottle, your milk bottle, and turning it over and dumping a lot of that stuff out and putting stuff in there that makes more sense. Yeah, Tom said, when we boomed into the railroad yards to find work in the logging camps, in the mines over in the Coeur d'Alene or on the wheat harvest, We got off of those freight trains. We could see the boss's private car parked on this edge of the yard. We could see the mansions growing up around cities like Spokane and Missoula and Seattle. And we knew that that wealth was coming out of our blood and our sweat underground and in the forest or out in the fields, you see. He said, yeah, it was a lot easier for us to figure out what we were fighting. Well, if it was easier to figure out the problem, it would probably be a little easier to figure out the solution, too.
Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Boob, why don't you buck like thunder and dump the bosses off your back? All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back. Bob, bob, bob.
Well, now, young hero, what is the plan for you, boss dumping-wise? What is the plan for you? Well, the boss's plan for you is first to take over the school system to make sure that you don't get out of that school with any information about the labor movement, any information about the things that I've been talking and singing about right now. No knowledge about how to control your working conditions, about how to join together with other people and form a union. All you're going to get about the labor movement is a bad rap. You know, that's right. Okay, that's part of the beginning of the plan. So you're just going to come out and get a job and become a grunt and sell your labor energy for whatever deal the boss offers you. Globally, I guess the plan is, in today's emerging global economy, as the presidents like to say, is for every wage worker to be an independent contractor. No union, no contractor, no contract, but every wage worker in direct competition with every other wage worker as an independent contract. At the lowest possible wage, no negotiation, take what you're offered, but responsible for your own health care, which have been abandoned to corporate health care systems, responsible for your own retirement, which has been abandoned to Wall Street, the big gambling casino in New York. Little or no workman's compensation, they're going to get rid of that. Few, if any, safety regulations, the things that we fought for to try to get back. That's the plan for you, is to simply be a producer and a consumer. and have to put up with whatever they give you. They are not going to give you anything they don't want you to have under the illusion that it's really what you want and what you need. I guess it was Marx that said, religion is the opiate of the masses. Well, I think that's changed some. I think maybe the opiate of the masses today might be credit. Let's listen to Chris Chandler.
So I was wrestling with this demon. Well, he wasn't really a demon per se. He was just kind of this lower-level emblem of evil. Well, not exactly evil. He was just really annoying. And we weren't exactly wrestling. I was just kind of dodging his phone calls. But they were really annoying phone calls from this emblem of annoyance, from this figure straight out of hell. Well, not hell exactly, from a collection agency. You see, I purchased Salvation on my credit card. Well, not exactly Salvation, but close. $500 worth of books on self-improvements, miracle diets, and books on angels, not to mention the added expense of a really comfortable reclining chair from which to seek salvation upon.
So I called up my entertainment lawyer, said my royalties have been shortchanged. The lawyer said your copyright's expired and your soul is public domain.
Now, I'm comfortable with the fact that a comfortable chair allows me to be comfortable while reading my self-help books, which teach me to be comfortable with myself. But now some of you soul-numb skeptics might deride the fact that I have charged over $500 worth of takeout pizza during this period of self-improvement. But how could I possibly absorb all the information in my diet books if I am too hungry to concentrate? This, after all, is a battle for my soul. Or at least as important, my credit rating, which is infinitely intertwined with my feelings of self-worth, which is infinitely intertwined with my need for self-help books, which is infinitely intertwined with my credit rating, which is, well, you get the point. I simply had to purchase this book on my Lord and MasterCard. Concerned with diet books? Ha! When was he not? I mean, he convinced the Jews to stay kosher, the Muslims to stay clear of swine, the Protestants to add mayonnaise to everything. So the way I see it, a higher power can certainly inspire a best-selling diet book, which gets me back to my holy war with a credit agency who claims that my entire life story will fit on file in their computer. My entire life story has come to this: a few electronic flashes of light, a billion angels dancing on the head of a microchip. Now that's diet to be able to do that, but where did these guys get off saying that I am a deadbeat? I want to tell that computer to mind its manners when it talks about me in public. If I ever see that smug son of a motherboard, I'm gonna call it out. But you can't. You can't fight what you can't see. It's like trying to take a swing at the gods themselves. Only the way I see it, the corporations are the gods themselves. They are faceless, elusive entities. They speak only in logos and slogans. They're everywhere. They see everything. In fact, sometimes you don't even know they're there until they hit you up with a corporate collection plate.
So I called up the telephone company to say that my bill was all wrong. They cut off my service. I lost my job. They had me on hold for so long.
Today, even Zeus would fall, overwhelmed and defeated before the great god Walmart. The gods aren't dead, they're just out shopping. Aphrodite bought a nightie at Victoria's Secrets while Eros joined a recovery group for sex addiction. He traded in his bow and arrows in the sporting goods department for a 9mm and was last seen headed to a high school in the deep south. Started NRA Safety Club, of course. Now Jesus, he's learned the score. He's learned from his many years of hanging around the wretched and the poor that there is a better way to market to them. He's opened up a megastore called Save Mart, and his plan is to put one in every street in the USA, put those pitiful Main Street churches out of business for good. He's more powerful than the Son of God. He's the CEO. For God so loved the world, he bought the company.
Showstopper. It rang from the mountaintops. Hey, hey, attention, Kmart shoppers. Oh, she rallied the faithful to bargains on salvation throughout the store. One
Welcome to God Mart.
Saturday night in limbo, and my credit is in limbo.
Have a nice eternity.
My life's akimbo. It's Saturday night in limbo.
Oh, Father, please forgive me for my credit ratings, as I forgive those who have bounced checks to me. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of too many inquiries and a poor debt-to-credit ratio, I would fear no evil if I just had a better credit rating. In the meantime, I'll settle for some TV and the holy deliverance of takeout pizza on earth as it is in heaven.
Burn them up, burn them up, cut them up. Take out your credit card, turn it into guitar picks. They make pretty good guitar picks, you know. Well now, given all of this, my young friend, maybe you just need to become an anarchist. I don't mean you're going to go out and trash something, you're going to break windows. I don't mean that you're going to go out and do what you damn well please. Nobody can tell me what to do. No, that's nihilism. You're going to become an anarchist. That means you're going to have to sit down and try to figure out the right thing to do. You are going to have to become self-governing. You are going to have to become the president of the United States of you. All right? Anarchy is not a noun. It is an adjective. It describes the tension between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, whether they're to be voluntary or coercive. We are born into any number of coercive combinations. Look at your socks. They're probably the same color. Did you decide that your socks need to be the same color when you took them out this morning to put them on? No, your culture decided that. That's cultural compulsion. And that hits you 1,000 times every day when you think what you're doing is voluntary, but in fact it isn't. It's culturally compelled. We're born into highly coercive cultural combinations like boss-employee, student-teacher, parent-child, lovers, marital combinations. All we ever wanted to do was to create voluntary combinations among ourselves as free, self-governing people, combinations of which we are the architects, combinations to which we describe, which serve our needs as we define them and not as they're defined for us, you see. You've got to find your work. The work which animates you, the work that puts some good in the world, that you can measure, that you can see, the work that satisfies your soul. Now, here's what you're going to do. You're going to take a lot of dumb jobs. You may have a good boss at this one, a bad boss at that one, but the boss is the boss, and you can't laugh off that curse. And you're going to work in this system, but you're going to take part of the money and part of the time left over, living cheap, to acquire the tools and the skills that you need to do your work. And you've got them. You're going to pick up the phone one day and call in well and start doing your work. And if it's something you find you can't do alone, you find people who are like-minded, who want to do the same work, and you form that voluntary combination, and you begin to get the work of the world done. Look, if you and I can agree that we will do our share of the work of the world, if you and I can agree that we will only take what we need and put back what we can, if you and I will agree that we will care for the afflicted, and most of all, if you and I will agree that we will not hurt anybody, all the things you can't get from the boss and from the state, well, we can form that voluntary combination and begin to get the work of the world done. Without the boss and without the state, we are singing for our lives.
We are a land of many colors. singing for our eyes. We are a gentle, loving people, and we are singing for our lives.
Well, that's it for Loafer's Glory this week. This has been Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the great Southwest, and happy May Day. Well, let's do this little poem for W, who, as this rotten system crashes and burns, is out there screaming, May Day, May Day. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled chickens yearning to cluck free, the wretched poultry of your teeming shore. Send these, the boneless fricasseed, to me. I laid my egg inside the golden door.